It is the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkan. Thanks for being here. Russia is reportedly planning to launch a wave of new attacks on Ukraine as the bloody invasion reaches the first anniversary later this month. We learned from an NPR producer about covering a war zone, grappling with the reality of reporting on the carnage. Call in with your questions, your views, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Wisconsin native Kat Lonsdorf is a reporter and producer for NPR's All Things Considered. Kat, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good to talk to you.
So as the war in Ukraine reaches this one-year mark, what are you reflecting on?
Oh, man. A lot, honestly. It's a little wild. I was there this time last year, actually, for NPR. They sent me, along with Mary Louise Kelly, one of the hosts on our show, and another producer, out in January and February of last year, just as we were kind of watching Russia build up forces on the borders with Ukraine, and wondering if they were actually going to invade. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, this time last year when we were there, I traveled all the way as far east as we could go in Ukraine and as far south, all the way to Kherson, to the boundary with Crimea. And everywhere we went, people really didn't think that this invasion was going to happen. You know, maybe it was wishful thinking, but there was just a lot of like, that won't really happen, will it? There's no way they can actually do this. And so this time, around this time last year, I remember just being like, I don't think it's going to happen. Mm. I don't think it's going to happen. And sitting in Kyiv and just kind of looking around and being like, you know, I think we'll be looking back on this a year from now and just be like, remember that time that Russia almost invaded? And so I'm actually thinking about that a lot. Now, just I guess how wrong we were, but also how sad it's been in the last year to watch us be wrong about that, or watch myself be wrong about that.
And Kyiv being over 5,000 miles from Madison, where your roots are, what is often misunderstood about the war?
You know, I think I've been there three times in the last year, once, as I said, before the war started, but then twice since the war has been going on. And every time I come back, when I, you know, talk to people and they find out that I've, you know, recently come from Ukraine or that I've been there during the war, I've noticed that one of the first questions I get over and over again from people is it really that bad? Mm. And it's an interesting question. It makes me sad, honestly, because I have to always just look at people and say, like, yeah, it is that bad. And maybe that's what I want people to know, as depressing as that is like, it really is as bad and probably way worse than what you are picturing it to be. You know, it's not bad all across the country. Ukraine is a giant country. If you look at a map, Ukraine is the largest country in Europe, other than Russia. And so it's huge. It takes forever to, you know, most of the time when we're there these days, we're driving and it takes forever to get from place to place. We're in the car a lot. And so it's not really bad everywhere. You know, out west in Lviv and near the, you know, near the parts that border the rest of Europe, it's, you know, you can kind of go through daily life and more or less forget that there's a war going on. There are air raid sirens and stuff, but generally you're just kind of living your daily life. But when you get out by the fighting out east and down south, it's really, really bad. Mm. And it is just as bad as people might think it is. And I think that's what I would like people to know, you know.
You mentioned logistics, being in the car a lot to get from one place to the next in coverage plans. You know, what would you say are necessary attributes of a journalist who is on assignment in Ukraine? What are the skills that we wouldn't notice or see when the full package of news is before our eyeballs, or, you know, in our ears?
You know, we're not sleeping at all, I'd say. I mean, we are, but you're operating on very little sleep. But I think also the thing that I think is important for people to know is that any journalist, at least any NPR journalist that's out there right now, has a whole team behind them. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be able to do my work without a team of people. And I know that's the same for all my colleagues. And that team is four or five people. So anytime I'm out, so it's not just like me wandering around a war zone, you know, with a microphone. And I want to make that extremely clear. I have a driver who my driver on this last trip was this lovely 24-year-old Ukrainian man. And I have a what's called a fixer, which is an interpreter, but also kind of a producer. They're making calls for you. They're interpreting your interviews in Ukrainian and Russian for you. They're helping set up your next interviews, your next stories, kind of helping you parse out the news that they're getting in Ukrainian. And I was working with a lovely woman this last time I was there, who's super smart. And then I have a security advisor who's with me pretty much all the time, who's monitoring the security situations, helping figure out where we can and can't go realistically. You know, when we're out near the front lines, he's kind of just listening to all the booms and trying to figure out if it's outgoing or incoming, and making sure we're wearing our safety equipment and making sure, you know, he'll tell us when to get out if he thinks it's getting a little too dicey. And then I often have a photographer with me as well. And so it's a whole team of people. And it really does take a whole team of people to do this kind of reporting, just because there's so many logistics, like you said. And it's also just like so exhausting that I don't think any one person could really turn out this much this quickly alone.
We're talking about the war in Ukraine with Kat Lonsdorf, reporter and producer for NPR's All Things Considered. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Kat, you've reported how some young Ukrainians bring joy to destroyed villages as they help clean up the debris. What are they doing?
Yeah, this was a group I spent time with in the area called Chernihiv. It's in the kind of northeast of the country, and it was occupied by Russia early on in the war. And then people might remember in around March or April, Russia pushed back from the north, from around Kyiv in this area. This group of young, you know, 20 and 30 somethings, mostly who lived in Kyiv, really wanted to get involved and help people out in these areas that were harder hit by the war. And so they put together this organization that just got a bunch of young people together to go help rebuild, well, not really rebuild houses. They're removing the rubble. So basically, you know, if you go into these liberated villages, what's left is basically rubble. A lot of places have been destroyed. A lot of houses have been destroyed. And a lot of the people who stay in the villages when Russians come in are older people. Mm. They don't want to leave their home. They sometimes can't leave their home. They're sick. They don't want to leave their animals. They don't want to leave their farm. And so when the Russians retreat and they're looking at what's left of their home, which is often not much. The first thing you have to do in order to be able to rebuild is remove all of the rubble, right? You know, all of the bricks, all of the walls that have fallen down. And it's really hard work. It's really heavy work. You know, a lot of these older folks just can't physically do that. Sure. And it's emotional, right? The emotional labor with rebuilding your house is huge.
I would imagine PTSD, such a major concern as we talk about it in our country, especially with veterans. How do Ukrainians handle the trauma of war when they've lost loved ones or all their possessions, as you're pointing out here, are in a pile of ruin?
I mean, I would say they're handling it as well as they can. I mean, how does anyone handle that? I think that the trauma of this war will not be fully understood until it's over. You know, what we know about trauma is that you can't really process it until you feel safe. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that kind of no one in Ukraine feels safe right now, because even if you're in a place that's not occupied by Russia, it could soon be, or it could be struck by a drone or a missile. So I think we won't really know you know, the full extent of the trauma that everyone suffered for a long time. You know, I would say that people there are trying their best. Ukrainians have a great sense of humor. Mm. So you'll often find yourself laughing while you're crying in Ukraine. And that's kind of how a lot of people are dealing with it. But, you know, yeah, the trauma that people are suffering there, it's not not really any different than any other war, right? War is just horrible anywhere. But the trauma is really, really deep, and it's not going away anytime soon.
NPR reporter and producer Kat Lonsdorf touring us through her recent reporting, giving us an inside glimpse of what days are like as a journalist in a war zone as Russia's invasion of Ukraine nears the one-year mark. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Verona, Wisconsin native Kat Lonsdorf, NPR reporter and producer for NPR's All Things Considered, as we explore her recent reporting and she shares her reporter's notebook on covering difficult environments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take a call now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi there. I just had a question about, given that Russia seems to have such vast resources and that it is an incursion on Ukraine's homeland, it seems unlikely that either side will achieve all-out victory as they see it before the war started. And I was wondering if you had gotten any feeling about whether the misery inflicted on the Ukrainian people had pushed them any closer to some sort of willingness to negotiate or some negotiated peace, I guess you'd say, at maybe not full-out victory.
Tom, thank you. What would you say there, Kat?
Oof. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think there's probably a lot of people across Ukraine who have various feelings on that. I would say President Zelensky has made it pretty clear that he wants full Ukrainian borders back. Maybe even going so far as to get Crimea back and before the 2014 invasion. So, you know, that would be a lot of land to get back. And I feel like he's kind of digging his heels more and more on that. It's a little hard to say right now what the end of this could really look like. I think that if you talk to Ukrainians near the front lines, they're just tired. But also, you know, there's a lot of Ukrainians who have been through a lot of the fighting who want to make the fighting worth something, right? So it's not I'm not giving you a great answer because I don't think there really is one way to say how Ukrainians generally are feeling.
But I wonder if you could bring up Dara Masico, the senior policy researcher at RAND Corporation, and that interview that you co-produced there about some of the political infighting and rival camps behind the scenes in Russia's leadership.
Yeah, I'm no expert on this, but I did help produce that interview. I mean, there's a lot to look at as far as whether Russia is, I guess, maybe reaching a point of dysfunction, maybe is an okay way to put it. There's this huge shakeup just, was it last week or the week before, recently, mm-hmm. Between the top leaders in Ukraine, who are leading the Russian side of the war in Ukraine. Putin basically ousted a man that he'd put in the job just in October and replaced him with his boss, essentially, a man who has been working in Ukraine and leading the war in Ukraine in a lot of ways. But there's a lot of thoughts around whether or not this shakeup was showing that, you know, Putin really didn't want to hear that they might be losing this war. The leader that he replaced was maybe one of the only leaders who was willing to speak frankly about what was needed and necessary in the war. And he's now replaced him with a bunch of yes men, essentially, who will probably do whatever bidding he wants in terms of expanding the war, even if it's beyond Russia's capabilities. So there's a lot of questions around whether Russia might be just stretched way too thin at this point, even though, I mean, like our caller said, they have a lot of resources in terms of a lot of troops, a lot of population. But that being said, you know, even when I was there in the fall, we saw that Russia was not only holding this kind of fake referendum, not kind of, it's an incredibly fake referendum in Ukraine in four areas, but also they had instated, you know, a partial mobilization call for men all over Russia, which went horribly. People were protesting, men were protesting, men fled. And we saw that they really didn't even have the resources to be training these men, from what we were hearing over the internet, at least. So you know, there's a lot of questions about whether Russia can really sustain this invasion, too, even though they are a giant country. And that's really something that we're all kind of looking at and wondering just how long can this go on from both sides, right?
Let's bring in Kevin in Krivets. Kevin, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yeah, I guess I'd just like to get your guest insight. There's a growing number of people who are, you know, saying that this whole thing that we're seeing on TV and reading about is fake. This is propaganda. There actually isn't a war going on in Ukraine, and that, you know, we're seeing paid actors. You know, I think we've seen this time and time again with other incidences. And I guess I'd just like to, you know, what would your guest say to those people that say this isn't even really happening?
Kevin, thank you. Kat?
I mean, I think I can say very, very, very strongly that it is definitely happening. Sadly, I wish it wasn't. I wish it wasn't in a big way. But I've been to the front lines, essentially. I mean, I haven't been to the actual front line, but I've been to all of the villages around, or many of the villages around the front lines, many of the recently liberated villages in the east and south, and I can tell you 100% that this is real and it's really happening, and that people are really, really suffering. So, you know, I understand people's skepticism these days, but I do think that it's very real. This war is very, very real.
Talking about the war in Ukraine with Kat Lonsdorf, reporter and producer for NPR's All Things Considered. In April last year, you met Lyudmila Boyka in Ukraine and realized you had mutual acquaintances here in Wisconsin. And then you later produced this gorgeous piece on this chance meeting for All Things Considered. What did you learn from working on this story?
You know, that was a wild story. I mean, just to catch people up if they didn't hear it. If we found out I was in Ukraine with NPR Scott Detrow and another producer, Noah Caldwell, and we were in this recently liberated town called Borodyanka. It's north of Kyiv. And we were just talking to people, and we came across this woman who was waiting for the bodies of her family members to be pulled out of the rubble of a destroyed apartment building. And we were talking to her. We talked to her for about an hour. And then, you know, we finished up the interview, and she was talking about how much she loved the U.S. and how she'd been to Wisconsin. And I was like, oh, I'm from there. And so we're talking, and she's like, oh, I've been to Verona. And I was like, what? I'm from Verona. And I had known that, you know, Verona had a connection with this town through a church, but I didn't expect to meet anyone who would have been there. And Lyudmila knew my neighbors and had stayed on my street in Verona, which I live in, like, you know, I grew up in the country. So it was very, very, very random. And I think, you know, that taught me just how small the world is, right? And, you know, what a wild chance meeting with this woman. And, you know, we both started crying immediately. she was crying. I was crying. We hugged. And it was just a really nice, special connection in this, like, very, very devastating moment and a very dark day. And it was lovely to follow back up with her, you know, 6 months later when I went back to Ukraine and went to see how she's doing and how she's faring.
How is she doing?
Not great, I guess I would say. She's a trauma counselor. She was trained partially in Madison by some professors when she would come to visit. And she kind of never thought she would be using her trauma counseling for her town. She thought she'd be using it for soldiers returning from the front lines in the east back in the you know, the war that started in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So she is overwhelmed with work at this point. You know, her town is getting functioning again 6 months after the Russians left. But she's just constantly meeting with people who are dealing with trauma. Basically, everyone in the town has trauma. And then she has her own trauma.
And she has to process her own trauma.
Exactly. So she's trying. But, you know, especially as a trauma counselor, she knows she's not really processing what she needs to right now. And I think, you know, she's struggling like a lot of people there are.
Kat, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me and for being interested.
Kat Lonsdorf is an NPR reporter and producer for All Things Considered. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tribute to a Wisconsin astronaut who tragically passed away 20 years ago today during the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster.
So many people dream of going to outer space, of becoming an astronaut. Laurel Clark, she made that a reality. As writer Dean Robbins tells us, the Wisconsinite strived for greatness her entire life.
Astronaut Laurel Clark's life ended abruptly on February 1, 2003, when the Space Shuttle Columbia exploded near the end of its mission. She was only 41, with a husband and an 8-year-old son. It's one of the saddest stories in NASA history, and yet, whenever I think about Clark, I don't focus on her tragedy. I focus on her smile.
3, 2, 1... We have booster ignition and liftoff of Space Shuttle Columbia with a multitude.
You see it in photographs from the mission as Clark poses with her 6 crewmates or floats through the cabin in her orange spacesuit. For someone who'd only recently envisioned herself in space, the Columbia experience was a dream come true.
Mission Specialist Laurel Clark, Payload Commander Mike Anderson, and Payload Specialist Ilan Ramon seated down on the mid-deck.
Back on Earth, Clark described herself as a boring straight-A student at Racine's Horlick High School. She earned both a bachelor's degree in zoology and a medical degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she blossomed intellectually. After college, Clark's life was anything but boring. She joined the Navy, served as an undersea medical officer, and became a flight surgeon. After marrying fellow Navy officer Jonathan Clark, she threw herself into parachuting, rock climbing, and scuba diving. Always on the lookout for new challenges, she hatched the idea of becoming an astronaut in her 30s. The space program turned her down on the first try and accepted her on the second, while she was pregnant. Family and friends recognized Clark's toughness. They knew she would follow her own path, no matter the risk, and that she would enjoy herself in the process. Days before Columbia's liftoff, she had this to say on Milwaukee's WISN-TV.
This mission is just extremely exciting, and I still feel very fortunate to be assigned to this mission. I'm excited to be a test subject because I think that's how we get answers, is by studying people. And as a physician, I understand how important it is to collect data on people.
In space, Clark conducted experiments on moths and roses and played Running to the Light by one of her favorite bands, Runrig. Nearly 200 miles above the Earth, she also maintained her ties to Wisconsin. Two of her in-flight experiments originated at the UW. Her gear included a UW Medical School medallion and a teddy bear with UW-Madison and zoology embroidered on its jacket. For 15 days, 22 hours, and 20 minutes, Clark reveled in the wonders of spaceflight. In an email to the folks back home, she described her view from the porthole. Lightning spreading over the Pacific. The aurora australis lighting up the entire visible horizon with the city glow of Australia below. The crescent moon setting over the limb of the Earth. The vast plains of Africa and the dunes on Cape Horn. Clark was especially happy to get a glimpse of the Wind Point Peninsula jutting into Lake Michigan near her childhood home in Racine.
Mere minutes before Columbia disintegrated due to a damaged wing, Clark was still in high spirits. The astronauts, unaware of the malfunction, joked around as she filmed them with a digital camera. After encouraging a crewmate to wave, Laurel Clark turned the camera on herself to provide one last image for posterity. It was a smile.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that story on Wisconsin astronaut Laurel Clark. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum. Empty the places of the mind. Run into the
light. Run into the light. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to a recent report from the nonpartisan Lincoln Institute for Land Policy that evaluated K-12 school funding streams in five states, including here in Wisconsin. Public schools in our state receive funding primarily through two sources, state general aid and local property taxes. But school districts are increasingly going to referendums to fill budget gaps. Call in with your questions about school funding in Wisconsin, the formula. Share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew Wyschowski is Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, one of the report authors. Andrew, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. Your report puts these five states under the microscope to investigate the interplay between property taxes and state aid for education budgets. How does Wisconsin compare to these other states?
So our theme in writing this report was that there is a dilemma, really, between funding education with the property tax when the property tax in many states is an unfavored tax, where legislatures try to limit the tax. And we see that in Wisconsin even more so than in the other states, where I think the legislature and the legislature over the years has putting forward school funding policy tried to limit property taxation through, as we know in Wisconsin, very tight revenue limits that don't exist anywhere else in the other states or anywhere else in the whole country.
I want to ask you, you know, property taxes have historically played a central role in funding K-12. Why is the local property tax the funding mechanism of choice for states?
I guess the question really is, what are the alternatives? And I think the answer, when one looks at sources of local government revenue. And I guess the first question is, do we want local governments to play a role in financing education? And do we want local school districts to have some ability to influence the level of spending and how money is spent? And I think most people would say, yes, that's an important part of the American tradition of having local government control. If that said, you need a source of local revenue. And the alternatives, if we don't have the property tax, are, for example, a sales tax. But a sales tax is easy to avoid. You can just shop in the next community over that might have a lower rate. An income tax, people could easily move to avoid paying income taxes. But property, you can't pick up and move your property. And that's the great benefit of a property tax, that it becomes an efficient tax because it can't be easily avoided.
But the frequent criticism, of course, is that it perpetuates inequities in school. Property wealthy communities contributing more money to their local schools, and that places, with smaller property tax bases don't have an equal shot there. What could be done to address those inequities?
Well, that's absolutely right, that any local tax is going to have inequities, and it's certainly true with the property tax. And there, is the role of state aid. And excuse me. And in Wisconsin, as in most other states, state aid is distributed in a way to try to reduce these inequities, to provide further aid for communities that have lower property taxes, lower property values than in districts that have high property based, big property tax bases. We don't do enough of that. State aid could be improved, but the system, and that's in the report, we try to say that a good school funding system needs a really mix of an effective state aid system with a property tax. And property taxes could be improved.
Go a little further on that. Why, is state government aid not that great equalizer that it should be, not leading to more equity and more equitable, per pupil funding?
Well, in Wisconsin, we have an equalization formula. And over the years, we've given more and more state aid, not through our equalization formula. And the equalization formula does give more money to property poor districts. We've expanded from over the last few years tremendously per pupil aid. And that gives the richest district in property wealth the same amount of money per pupil as the poorest district. So that works against equalization. Mm. And in addition to that, we take no account of the fact that some districts, because of their small rural districts, because they have many students from poor families or a heavy concentration of disabled students, it's just the ability of given education. And most states, almost 40 states, use what are called weighted pupils. So they count more.
And I want to get into weighted pupils in just a moment, because we're having a little bit of connection issues here with Andrew Reshofsky, Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at UW-Madison, co-author of a report examining how local property taxes and state aid fund public education in five different states, including Wisconsin. Join in with your questions about school funding formulas. Share your thoughts on what schools need. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We unpack this study from the Massachusetts-based Lincoln Institute for Land Policy, examining the landscape of school funding in five states, including here in Wisconsin. Public schools in our state have increasingly asked voters to approve local school referendums to fill gaps. Be part of this conversation. Call in with your questions about property taxes, how to fund schools, 800-642-1234. We have Andrew Reshofsky, Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at UW-Madison and one of the report authors. Andrew, we were talking here about what is that correct mix and between local property taxes and state aid to fund education. How should states and school districts approach balancing these two revenue streams?
So on the one hand, I think states can make an effort to improve the property tax, to make it function more effectively. And in Wisconsin, the approach has been to put on revenue limits, to give tax credits that require local school districts to just lower their property tax rates. And that's a very untargeted way of giving property tax relief. It gives property tax, you get more relief the bigger your property is. You don't have to be a state resident. And we would do much more effective in achieving the goal, I think, of the legislature of helping lower property tax burdens if we targeted them to people who really where property tax was high relative to their incomes. And we don't do much of that in Wisconsin. And that is one way in which property tax would be less objectionable as a source of funding for public education.
Meanwhile, in Wisconsin last year, you know, voters saw the highest number of school referendums since 2001. You know, referendums that are things like trying to keep the lights on, trying to give teacher salaries a boost. What does that signal about the funding formula?
I think what it signals is not the funding formula per se, but that we have a very strict revenue limits that not only limit property tax revenue, but equalization aid. And so the state can give more money for aid, and school districts are forced to lower their property tax, not use it for spending. So local citizens, the only thing they can do is go to override to improve public education and spend more on their students. And so reforming the revenue limits, which are tighter than any other revenue limits in any other state, I think would be a first priority.
How do you go about reforming the revenue limits? What are your suggestions?
Well, my suggestion would be to think about either relaxing tremendously or even better, maybe eliminating the revenue limits. And the question would be then, oh, property taxes will skyrocket. They will go up. And I think that's an incorrect assessment. One, local citizens wouldn't allow property tax rates to go up and spending to increase tremendously. And if we replace the revenue limits with what one might call targeted property tax relief, we have homestead credits in the state, which give money to property tax relief to homeowners who have high property taxes relative to their income. But the existing program is only restricted to people with extremely low incomes. It doesn't give much relief. It hasn't, those parameters haven't been changed since 2010. It impacts very few taxpayers in Wisconsin. That program could be substantially expanded, and in that way, it would protect those homeowners and renters who really do face hardships from paying high property taxes relative to the amount of money that they have relative to their income.
Let's take a call on this. Steve in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi. What would you like to ask?
Yeah, you know, one of the concerns that we have with the property values in the formula is that property value isn't necessarily a measurement of wealth. You have people who may invest significantly in their property because that's where they want to invest their money, maybe lifestyle, whatever. But there's a lot of people that invest in the 401ks, invest in the stock market, invest in businesses, and here they're not taxed. Yet these other people are basically renting their property from the government. Doesn't seem fair. And the other focus really is spending. Why are we spending so much money?
Steve, thank you. Andrew, do you want to tackle those two questions?
Sure. Let me start with the spending question. In fact, spending has not gone up in Wisconsin. And many years ago, we used to be above average spending state with spending, education spending per pupil. And that's changed over time. And we are now below average. I think schools across the state have been impacted by the revenue limits, by reductions in the revenue limits and reductions in state aid. The question of should we be taxing property or taxing income or other sorts of wealth? We do tax wealth through the income tax, which helps then fund state aid. State aid comes from income taxes and sales taxes that we all pay.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment. Andrew Rutschofsky, Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at UW-Madison, looking at recent research in the role of property taxes in K-12 budgets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jeff now in Stevens Point. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
My question would be, where does the United States, before we start talking about more money, where does this U.S. and Wisconsin fall in a per pupil spending for education? And after we look at that, how do we hold failing schools accountable? I'm not saying that all are, but there are schools out there that are public schools that are definitely failing their students. And how do we hold them accountable and improve that before we start throwing more money at that situation?
Jeff, thank you. And accountability, by the way, not part of this report, but Andrew, go ahead.
Sure. That's always an issue. We want to spend money and spend it efficiently and effectively. And I think most of the school districts in Wisconsin do a very good job in with the resources they have. They're often greatly constrained. That doesn't mean that they aren't schools and school districts that maybe don't operate as effectively as possible. And in part, we have the Department of Public Instruction, which has accountability standards. And maybe in some cases, they should use them more forcefully to generate and pressure school districts to operate, to improve their education.
Some states, provide refunds for people whose property tax payments are deemed too high. These are circuit breaker programs. How do these programs differ from state to state? What did you learn here?
So we, as I mentioned, we do have a circuit breaker, the homestead credit in Wisconsin, but it is very tightly constrained and very small. And one of the things in some states allow those programs to be much more robust. In other words, middle-class citizens who have high taxes relative to their incomes, particularly the elderly, qualify for those programs. And the amount of property tax refund, as you said, that an individual can get is much higher than it is in Wisconsin. So we've not only limited those who can benefit from that program, we've also made the program very small and haven't changed the parameters. And in other words, the income limits and the maximum credits now since 2010.
In the few moments we have left, is there any role for the federal government in addressing school funding at the local level?
I think there is. As most people know, the federal government does play a role, but a relatively small role, and certainly a small role relative to most other countries. There are now new challenges, particularly the challenge coming from COVID-19 and learning loss that we see in Wisconsin and elsewhere. And the federal money, the federal government's done a lot, but that money effectively has to be spent by 2024. And recent research suggests that the legacies of COVID-19, the negative legacies in terms of learning loss, are going
to be
go
with us a long, for a long time. Andrew, thank you for joining us. Andrew Reshofsky, Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. We have a link to the report at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.